Hey, everybody. I'm Karen Hart Glass, and thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food. So I'm just juggling here because my Wi-Fi just went out. How is that? But thankfully, I have many different methods of technology here. And, the little green light is flashing. Anyway, I have my phone, and the phone works. It's all good. Lots to be thankful for, like phones and Wi-Fi and options. Thank you for joining me today on It's All About Food. So you may know that just a few days ago was Earth Day, April 22nd, and my birthday. And I'm grateful to all of you who sent me some very nice wishes. I want to direct you, if you have an opportunity, to my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com, to my daily blog, What Vegans Eat. I did a special one on my birthday, day 802. So I hope you'll check that out. Yes. Now, let's go. I want to bring on my first guest, Barbara J. King. She is Emerita Professor of Anthropology at the College of William and Mary in Williamsburg, Virginia, and now is a full-time freelance science writer. Barbara has written or edited many books on anthropology and animal behavior. Her latest, just published in March, is Personalities on the Plate, The Lives and Minds of Animals We Eat. Her How Animals Grieve from 2013 has been translated into Japanese, Portuguese, French, winning a book prize, and Hebrew. King's essay on animal mourning in Scientific American was chosen for inclusion in the Best American Science and Nature Writing 2014. She blogs each week for National Public Radio's 13.7 Cosmos and Culture blog. Welcome to It's All About Food, Barbara.
Hi, Karen. I've been so looking forward to talking with you.
Yes, and so have I, and I'm just trying to stay calm right now as I'm juggling with my technical challenges here. But fortunately, I hear you. You hear me. Everybody hears everybody? Yes?
Yeah, I'm hearing. Yes, I can hear clicking noises, but I can still hear you.
Okay, good. All right. Well, as I try and bring my computer back to life, let's just move forward. So I really enjoyed reading your book, Personalities on the Plate. And the thing that I find so important, as I like to think we're evolving as humans, is that we are able to view other species of life in a different way than perhaps we've perceived them all this time. I know as a performing artist, for example, an actor, we always try to empathize with the role that we're in, the character we're playing. And that's difficult enough. But to try and understand what other species are experiencing and feeling is, I don't even know if we can do that. But your stories in your book are helping us have a much better understanding. So one of the things is the patience, I imagine, that's required in observing so that you can write about other species. Is that true?
Oh, yes. I think that watching animals carefully does take time and focus, but what a joy to do as we look at animals in the wild and anywhere from, you know, the oceans to national parks to our backyard. And my work combines some observations that I've done in the past on our closest living relatives, like monkeys and apes, with reliance on what a lot of other people have experienced. And I'm always saying that I'm not, of course, trying to figure out what other animals are thinking, but that they're giving us lots of clues through their behavior to how smart they are and the fact that they're leading, in many cases, profoundly emotional lives. And if we get to know animals and really watch them as closely as we can in their natural context, I think it becomes sort of an amazingly wonderful experience to see how much intelligence and how much emotion we really do share with other animals.
Well, that's such a telling point, because how is it that rather than seeing all of these other species as somewhat similar to us because we share so much in common, we've decided that they're so different?
Well, that is really the question. And what I say in my new writing is that I think we have trained ourselves to, and I mean we in a qualified way, you'll understand that, many of us have trained ourselves to be fascinated by, you know, elephant cognition and how smart dogs are and how chimpanzees feel. But when it comes to farmed animals, the wall goes up, the distance goes up, and we don't want to know. And, of course, I'm excluding your audience from this, but I'm talking about most people. Most people don't want to grapple with the fact that animals that many people eat are, you know, living their lives with true reflection in many cases, the ability to think things through, certainly a strong desire to want to live, and strong bonds of love and grief. So it's generally a question of, you know, why don't we want to see animals in a certain way? But even more specifically, it's the animals that we do choose to engage with in that way and those we don't.
It is indeed complicated. So let's jump to the first topic you cover in your book, insects and arachnids. And there's definitely I definitely get the ick factor when thinking about eating insects. And you talk throughout the book about what different cultures accept as food and what others may find is not appealing as food. It has a lot to do with how we're brought up. But I knew this, but it became more apparent when I was reading it in your book about the quantity of insects we consume without even realizing it.
Yeah, that's right. And I think there are these fascinating equations published, you know, eat a jar of peanut butter, eat a chocolate bar, and you're consuming, you know, so many insects. And perhaps that's just inevitable in our current food system. But, of course, entomophagy is about something very different, the purposeful eating of insects. And this, I think, raises a number of really fascinating ethical questions. You know, is it the case that eating insects might, in fact, save some mammals from, you know, being consumed, being produced in agriculture, being consumed? Or do we really want to, and I think the latter is the case, also start thinking about the ethics of consuming, you know, these living creatures as well? If we think for how long the world was kind of convinced that fish don't feel pain, and now, of course, we know they do, we don't want to take it at face value that insects don't feel pain. So yep. I'm kind of wanting to walk that line, and I don't want to dismiss entomophagy by any means in terms of an ethical system, but at the same time, I don't want to repeat mistakes of the past where, you know, you hear very frequently, well, insects, they don't need a lot of space. They, you know, we can easily and humanely kill them. Well, you know, what does that remind you of? What conversation does that remind you of? The whole question of course, humane meat and humane killing and what, you know, what we should take at face value. So it really, there's a lot of sides to entomophagy to consider.
Well, this concept of saying certain things, certain beings don't feel pain, as you just mentioned. I even think about when we talk about circumcision of a human baby mm-hmm. boy, mm-hmm. there were many who said that the baby didn't feel pain. And, you know, now there were more people who believe circumcision is necessary. Some will do it with anesthesia. We know those babies feel pain. And I mean, it's just so many things that we just choose not to want to think about or not to want to see. And, you know, I have to believe that with insects, okay, they're small, but so are microchips. And we continue to figure out how to squeeze so much more complicated information into a smaller space on a chip. What makes us think that these tiny insects don't have some complicated thought processes going on? Maybe not the same as ours, but they certainly do some incredible things. I mean, I'm sure you've seen those pictures of the ant farm art. And some, have you seen those pictures of the guy that does the sculptures in ant hills?
I did. I haven't spent time with them, but I do know what you're referring to.
They're horrifying. I mean, to begin with, in order to make that art, the artist had to destroy so many ants because they poured all this, whatever the material he was using into the anthill. But then we get to see what's really going on underground, and it's just fascinating how they know how to construct their home.
Yes, and quite recently there was a very fascinating study, too new for my book certainly, to show that bees are capable of very thoughtful imitation in ways that have been long thought to just be, you know, something birds or maybe monkeys and apes do. So if you ask bees to roll a ball, something that they obviously would never do naturally, to a target in order to receive sugar water, which is a reward for them, they can learn to do this. But what's more exciting is that they learn sort of more efficiently if they watch a demonstrator bee. That's social imitation. And that shows all kinds of levels of sophistication about how you would want to copy something that someone's doing and how to do that and all kinds of other things. There's all kinds of stuff coming out about fruit flies making decisions and crickets learning all the time that I think does bear on this conversation in just the way that you suggested, packing a lot into a small brain.
Okay, so now I'm jumping around because you talked about this social imitation, and I was reading later in your book, was it with pigs? How they were easily trained when a human trained them, but they didn't learn from each other for some of the social things that they were trying to be taught?
Oh, I think you may be thinking of goats, possibly.
Oh, it was goats, yeah.
Goats are very smart. You know, this is a sort of time period where there's a goat meme, a goat flare-up, a goat trope going on in our country where everybody wants now little cute goats. And you know how that goes. People get very interested in having pets for a while, and then it doesn't become so interesting anymore. But what I wanted to do is really look at the science, and the book, of course, is based in science, of goat cognition, and it's quite surprising. You know, as you know, I'm sure, goat is an extremely popular meat globally. And again, it's one of those things where it's easy to fall into a trap for some people of, you know, going along with the stereotype of goats as sort of, you know, satanic or dopey or, you know, oversexed or what, you know, pick whatever stereotype. And in fact, when, you know, I was learning and reading about them, I was very moved by what they're able to do in terms of reflection and in terms of learning how to open, say, very complicated fruit boxes. This was carried out at Buttercup Sanctuary in Kent, England, a complicated set of steps that they could remember how to do after 311 days, which is a quite prodigious memory. In fact, they did not very much pay attention to each other. They didn't pay attention in terms of social learning, as I just described for the bees. But that's just their species-specific way of learning. So, you know, it doesn't make them any less smart. It's just the way they go about things.
It doesn't make them any less smart. And every species has their own special skills and knowledge and understanding. But I was just kind of fascinated that the bees, which we would think are not necessarily correctly or smartly, are so far less intelligent than we are, would be able to do something that a goat didn't do.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you said a goat didn't do, because, you know, I think that these experiments tap into some of the sort of social organization and natural evolved tendencies of these animals. But as a person who studied monkeys and apes for a long time, I can tell you that lots of primates that don't use tools in the wild will do so under certain circumstances experimentally. In other words, they have the capacity, even when they don't necessarily show the behavior. So I would be interested in knowing under what circumstances might goats do that, and that I don't know has been done. But you're right, that part of the joy of writing this book was delving into animals that I had an inadequate understanding of. And, you know, the octopus is another, an invertebrate, and you know, sort of off the charts smart invertebrate. So when this group of scientists got together in 2014 and they devised the Cambridge Declaration of Consciousness, you know, urging us to think about how many animals in our world are conscious and reflective, they included the octopus, which is now sort of the poster animal for invertebrates, because they use tools, they reflect on what they're doing, they can solve problems in ways that, you know, so many of us just dismissed for so long, because an octopus, you look at it and it's hard to necessarily see what we can see in a mammal that we may use to be looking at, or a bird. But an octopus, you know, whatever he or she does is clearly based in just a lot of sophistication.
There are many wonderful stories in here. Some of them are just stories from animals that end up in sanctuaries and are protected. Some of them become companion animals. And then some are summaries and results from different scientific studies that have gone on. And they're all fascinating. I imagine that setting up a scientific study to be able to determine whether a species is doing something or is aware of something, I imagine that's an incredibly complicated task.
Well, I think back to the book that I did on grieving that you mentioned in your introduction, How Animals Grieve. And, you know, people would push back, which is a good thing. You know, we want to have a dialogue. That's how science proceeds. And ask me, perhaps I was anthropomorphically projecting what I wanted to see in other animals, because clearly I'm an animal lover. I want to see animals as smart and intelligent. But my answer to that is, right, we don't know what an animal's thinking. But if we look very carefully, say an animal has lost a partner, a friend, a relative, and we know something about that animal in its normal behavior before this loss, and then we compare the before to the after, again, the animal itself is telling us something that I believe can be translated into a statement about its expression of emotions. And this, of course, goes way back to Charles Darwin. Charles Darwin wrote fascinatingly about the prodigious emotional expression of animals. So it's possible to do this, I believe, scientifically, carefully, conservatively. So elephants, of course, are the touchstone in grieving, because we know, we can see it so clearly. When an elephant matriarch dies and others come, stand vigil or rock in a distressed way over the body, or socially withdraw and don't eat, that for elephants clearly seems to be grief, and it would be hard-pressed to call it anything different. Then you get to know other animals and look at what their behaviors are after a death. And, of course, in some cases, there's indifference. There's complete neglect of the body and indifference. So animals differ one from another just like we do. But, I truly think that the clues are there to look at.
Absolutely. You covered, in addition to insects and pigs and fish, chickens and cows, mm-hmm, and chimpanzees. You mentioned about chickens. I've heard numerous chicken stories, just how wonderful and loving they can be. And Karen Davis has shared many through her organization. But you also included that one chick in particular who had been bullied when her aggressor became blind, the chicken was able to take out her anger back on her bully.
Yeah, and I did this for a very specific reason, and that is that I don't think it does, you know, any of us any good to romanticize animals. And I live with what sometimes it feels like an astonishing number of rescued cats, and sometimes we have cats that just act meanly to each other. They're good animals, but they sometimes are in a bad mood, or they just feel like being obnoxious. And that's the way that some animals can sometimes be, even when they're basically very loving. There's also the difference in personality. And sometimes, you know, you get a chicken who's just not a very nice chicken. And what I think that that does is it further reinforces the fact that these animals do have personalities, that they do have their own lives, that they get up every day, they want to live, they want to have a good day, right? They don't want a bad day, and sometimes they have bad days. So there's lots of stories in the book of compassion and kindness, but there's the other end of the spectrum too on occasion, and that's, you know, being alive, right? That's what it means to be a complicated individual or set of individuals.
Well, when we see other species that aren't always very nice to their own, does that make it okay that we're not nice to our own sometimes?
Oh, well, I thought you were going to ask me, does it make it okay that we're not nice to other animals? You know, one question I frequently get is, you know, why isn't it okay for me to eat a chicken when, of course, animals kill and eat each other all the time? Well, I would say in two parts. I'm not, you know, instructing anyone what to eat or not to eat. I don't eat chickens, and I never will eat a chicken. Okay. But to me, that's a very sort of false equivalence, because we never evolved specifically to eat meat. We did eat meat in our evolutionary past, but part of the result of eating meat in our evolutionary past is that we have an abundantly complicated brain that allows us to take into account ethics and compassion in ways that I don't think other animals do. So I think the answer is no. You know, it's not okay to treat each other badly. It's not okay to treat other animals badly. And let's take the fact that evolution has, you know, gifted us with these brains and use them in some ways that make sense. You know, this, we don't say that we all want to live in the way that we evolved, right, as human beings, you know, thousands and millions of years ago. We don't wish to recreate the society that we came from. So in the same sense, we need to be on a different trajectory and think differently about the who that we're eating rather than the what.
Absolutely, the who that we're eating. I'm glad that science is moving along and starting to open up and change perceptions of other species. But I'm just thinking some of the things we already talked about in terms of humanity. We all have a wide, vast range of skill sets depending on who we are, where we've grown up, what time period we've grown up in, and what part of the world we're in. And some of us adapt very naturally to some things where others of us don't. And when we talked about those particular goats that didn't learn socially very well and the bees did, maybe if we conducted similar experiments on humans, we'd see that some were able to do things that others weren't. That makes it even more complicated, I imagine.
Well, I think as an anthropologist, I would want to underscore that at the population level, we don't expect to find differences in learning and intelligence, because, of course, that gets into the bad old colonial past, right? So we, you know, there is a common human capacity for learning and intelligence. What, of course, changes the trajectory are different individual life experiences and choices and resources and opportunities. And I think that probably plays into this question in a large way.
Yes, well, there's so much we will not know for a very long time about all those other species, but I'm glad we're starting to dig. So let's just take a moment. I want to talk about chicken pot pie.
Mm.
So you mentioned that there are some foods that you still, you know, miss, I guess, and you haven't been able to find a good chicken pot pie that's made with a plant chicken.
Oh, do you have a good recommendation for me?
I probably could make it for you, but I'm just wondering, what is it about the chicken pot pie in your memory that hasn't been satisfied?
Yeah, well, you know, I think that it is probably far more than just the taste and the texture, but a very cultural experience. And, of course, as I said, I don't eat chickens anymore, and I, you know, just think of this as a comfort food, if you will, a food that made me feel secure. I would eat with family or loved ones. It just was, for a number of years, my go-to food when I needed to feel secure and safe and loved. And now I have different go-to foods that don't involve chicken. But I think part of the reason I brought that up is because changing, I mean, you know, and I'm certainly not telling you anything you don't know. I mean, I'm learning a lot on this question from animal activists and vegan activists, is how hard it can be to get people to think differently. You know, whenever I write at NPR or my books or elsewhere about, you know, here's an intelligent chicken, or here, look at what this pig did, and this is so cool, you know, the jokes come back inevitably about, you know, bacon and barbecue, and it just sort of never ends. And I really want to try to understand, what is that impulse when one person is feeling deeply about an animal, for someone else to sort of, you know, to do that or to say that? What is it about the way that food has taken on meaning for them that causes that? And that's something I still struggle with.
You are not alone on that one. That's the million-dollar question, or the billion-dollar question. What makes each one of us tick? And some people who appear so sensitive and compassionate still cannot connect the dots when it comes to the treatment of animals, especially for food.
Yeah, I have been describing myself as, I would say, experimental. I'm experimenting with new vegan cheeses and vegan milks, and, you know, I eat almost all vegan and vegetarian meals now. And this has been a change in recent years. And so I do try to remember that, you know, some years ago I was in a very different position myself, which I suppose is helpful to think about.
Absolutely. Well, I've been a vegan for almost 30 years, and I've always found that the best way to get people interested in eating this way is to put delicious food in their mouth, and that's been a part of my journey, just creating wonderful, delicious food that is vegan. So people don't feel like they're going to be deprived as their minds are opening up to the truth of what's really going on. So I was just curious about the pot pie, and I have wonderful memories of pot pies, but mine were always made by Swanson. And I'm imagining that the kind that I make today are such higher quality and better, even without the chicken, just because I'm making them from scratch.
Oh, I have no doubt.
Yeah. Anyway, I love talking about food. Great. Barbara, thank you so much for joining me today on It's All About Food. Sorry for the technical difficulties at the beginning of the program. This is a great book, Personalities on the Plate. Thanks for writing it.
Thank you so much, Karen. Bye-bye.
Okay, take care. That was Barbara J. King, the author of Personalities on the Plate, The Lives and Minds of Animals We Eat. This is an excellent read for anyone, people who are vegan, vegetarian, or omnivores. It's written from a very open and safe point of view, non-judgmental, and some really wonderful stories. Lovely.